Dante hustled after him, boots skidding in the grass. Instinctively, he reached for the nether, drawing the dark power from the shadows of the rocks, the undersides of leaves, the night air itself. It coiled around his wrist, so perfectly black most people couldn't see it at all. Blaze swished through the carpet of brown needles, one sword swinging from his hip, the other bouncing from his back. Dante threaded through the gnarled trunks. By the time they reached the base of the hill, the stones at its crown were blurs in the mist. "Well," Blaze said, "if the Watcher was here, you probably spooked him. Sounds like he'd deserve it, creeping around in the fog like that." Dante turned in a slow circle, scanning the trees for movement, flashes of color, but saw nothing but the pressing gray air. A stick snapped among the trees. Blaze's smile vanished. Dante drew the nether closer. Just ahead, a hulking figure plodded through the fog. 7 feet tall, shoulders so solid he looked as if he could walk straight through the trees without slowing down. "Hello, Morn," Dante said. "Bit late, aren't you?"
"Aren't we all, sooner or later?" the Norrin said.
He gazed down at his sodden pants cuffs with exasperation too deep for a sigh. His silver and bone earrings glinted in the darkness.
"Can we do this down here, or do we have to trek up to that fallen down garbage up there?"
"Your people built them."
"So they claim."
"Here's fine," Blaze said.
"Good."
Morn ran a thick hand over the equally thick beard that grew from every inch of his face besides a gap around his eyes, and a small patch directly below his cavernous nose.
"So, about the bow?"
"Yes," Dante said.
"The clan would like to know how they can be sure they can trust you."
Dante scowled. "We've been in and out of these hills for 2 years now."
"Spend 2,000 more, and we'll be on equal footing."
"Our word," Blaze said,
"is good for a laugh."
Morn's bovine eyes considered Blaze.
"Nothing personal."
"Who could take offense to that?" Dante glared into the fog. Over a year ago, he stopped thinking of his duty in the territories as a political favor to be discarded at the first sign of trouble. Instead, he now regarded it as something he wanted to do, a cause he'd fight for, even if Cali weren't forcing him to be here. He liked the Norrin. He believed in them. The problem was such feelings were rarely mutual. The Norrin, in large part, distrusted anything that came from beyond the territories. Hell, most of the time they distrusted anything that came from the wrong part within the territories, meaning anything beyond their village or their clan's roving range. No matter how much time Dante spent here, he kept having to prove himself to each new Norrin and clan he met. Sometimes he built up a relationship with a group, returned 6 months later, and found himself treated as a stranger again. The trust he'd established eroded like a beach during the storm season. The whole experience was so frustrating, there were times he wanted to smash a block down on the Norrin's oversized heads. By Norrin standards, Morn had been extremely trusting to date. Against his better judgment, Dante had cultivated hope his whole clan would be the same. Open. Helpful. Faced with the truth, his hopes came crashing down. "I don't even know what the Clan of Nine Pines is, exactly," Dante said. "How am I supposed to know what they consider worthy of trust?"
"Oh."
Morn's disappointment was as thick as the fog.
"Well, I'm off then."
Blaze glanced between them. "That's it?"
"It's a long walk home."
Dante stood stunned, watching the Norrin slog into the trees. At times he believed it was all a game the Norrin played, these endless spirals of approval winning and worth proving, and that when Morn returned home to tell this story, he'd be met with bearish laughter and grinning shakes of the head.
gullible outlanders.
Would probably give their own balls a whack if you told them a man's testicular fortitude was considered an equal sign of the fortitude of their loyalty. He shook his head. This business with Morn and the clan was just the latest fence they'd have to hop. Under Kali's direction, he and Blaze had burned 2 years arranging and bodyguarding shipments to and from the Norrin territories to the south. Silver, swords, spears, great wains of grain. He met with village leaders, brokered peace and pacts with the human settlements on the fringes, delivered memorized messages too sensitive to be trusted to a page. Days and weeks and months spent preparing the territories for something they would never have dreamed possible. Independence from the Empire of Gask. Throughout his travels, he began to hear rumors of the Clan of the Nine Pines, who, along with their Dreaming Bear and Three-Part Falls, were widely considered one of the fiercest clans in all Norrindom. But, again, according to rumor, they had something else on top of that. The Quivering Bow. When Dante asked what that was, the Norrin had smirked knowingly. Why, it was just a legendary weapon whose arrows sent enemy walls shivering down like the banks of a flash-flooding river. From that point on, Dante learned all he could about the Nine Pines, which wasn't much. Like most of the other clans, they were nomads. They traveled on foot, were rarely seen, and almost never spent time among the civilized city-dwelling Norrin. In the past, the Nine Pines paintings sold for sums that could have established estates. In present times, they were said to forge swords that never lost their edge. That, in itself, was interesting. But what had really snared the bunny was the bow. A bow that maybe, probably, didn't exist. When he first voiced his interest to Blaze, Blaze had dismissed the whole thing with a broad swipe of logic. If the bow were real, why wasn't the clan of the Nine Pines picking their teeth with the king's bones right now? To Dante, that didn't prove anything. You couldn't free a people or conquer an empire with a single weapon, no matter how powerful that weapon may be. You needed soldiers. Lots and lots of soldiers. Most clans only had 40 or 50 of those. And the fact the clans weren't exactly fond of banding together was perhaps the main reason so many of their people were enslaved across Gask. Still, in the months since learning about the bow, his hope had cooled. Until he met Morn, the first member of the Nine Pines he'd seen with his own eyes. Because what if the bow were real? It's all bullshit anyway. Blaze's virtual mind-reading had grown increasingly common, and somewhat unsettling, the more time the two spent with each other. If it comes to war, our best weapon's going to be stabbing. Lots of stabbing. That's your answer to everything. That's because it's such a good one. Now, can we get out of here already? Dante stirred fallen leaves with the toe of his boot. I'm sick of these games. If they drop all the ritual and let us do what we're here for, we'd already be hoisting their flags over the ramparts of Setevan. Blaze gave him the sort of frown reserved for the unanticipated expulsion of something that was just in your body. Then cut through the games, dummy. Follow Morn back to them. The clan would not care for that at all. He scanned the forest floor for anything white. Hope you've got your chasing shoes on. Now help me find something dead. I'm beginning to hate those words. If it makes you feel better, it can be alive. Until you get your hands on it. If the rabbit's family comes seeking satisfaction, I promise to stand as your second. Dante stooped and shuffled through the damp mulch. Finding a spare body, he had long ago learned, was much trickier than common sense tells you. In a world of living things, you would imagine the ground would groan with the fallen dead, that beneath the forest skin of leaves and needles would lurk a second layer of bones and fur. But animals occupied a small corner of any given space. They were so rare, in fact, that when they dropped dead, their remains tended to get snapped up by any other creatures who shared the area. A nice enough truth when the goal is walking through the woods without plunging ankle-deep into a former muskrat. Not so nice when the goal is to put that muskrat to one last use. Blaze crunched through the leaves uphill. Dante smelled fresh mould and wet dirt. Morn was getting further away by the moment. Dante straightened, relaxing his gaze until his vision blurred. It was perhaps that very rarity of remains that made them stand out so sharply. If only you knew how to look. Possibly it was that corpses still held on to some trace of the nether, the grist of Aron's flawed mill, that quickens all mortal life. Whatever the reason, within moments a cold, silver light glimmered at the base of a nearby pine, flickering like moonlight on a pool. Dante knelt to brush away the leaves. A faded whiff of decay rose from a scatter of small bones. Hair and sinew clung to ribs and joints. Dante smiled. Black wisps gathered in his fingers. Needing no more than a dab of blood, he picked a shallow scab on the back of his hand, waited for the small red bubble to rise, then touched his blood to the bones. Like rain on a window, shadowy nether slid from his hands to the body. Claws twitched. As if drawn by a string, a loose femur drew to the hip. The creature stood, swaying. It might have been a rat once, a squirrel. Now it was a silent automaton, and if Dante closed his eyes, he could see through its perspective instead. He nodded in the direction Morn had gone minutes earlier. The creature turned and dashed away in a spray of leaves. Dante called Blaze from down the hill. "We'll stay a mile behind him. He'll never know we're here. Next time, I demand a plan with less walking, like sitting around being fed roast pork." "I'm not sure how that forwards the cause of Norrin independence." Lay shrugged. "They can figure that out for themselves." The creature raced along the forest floor, skidding through leaves, leaping over roots and dips, unhampered by the need to breathe or rest or slow for treacherous footing. Within minutes, it, and by extension Dante, could hear the Norrin threading through the brush with surprising grace. He and Blaze began their pursuit. Mist drifted between the hard-barked pines, thinning the further they got from the river. After a couple miles of woods, the forest dissipated in favor of grassy hills. The draws and folds furred by spicy-smelling pines. The light of a half-moon drenched the trailless earth. Dante's breath rolled from his mouth in thin clouds. His nose and ears numbed while sweat dampened his underclothes, which were already a good week in need of a wash. Morn didn't take his first break until dawn took its first pink glance at the east. Blaze sat, blear-eyed, scowling at the block of bread Dante had taken along in case they didn't wind up returning straight to town after the meet. "This stuff's hard as a brick," he said, spraying crumbs. "Tastes like one, too. Yet you're eating it. Remind me not to invite you to my house. What's that hairy jerk doing now?" Dante closed his eyes. More than a mile away, the creature watched from beneath a bush while Morn pried the bark from a fallen log and ate the pale grubs beneath. "Enjoying a pan of bacon. I think I can smell it. Crisp meat. Smoking fat. God damn it!" Morn rose, then crouched beside a body of water that was more puddle than pond. "The wine looks good, too. At least tell me he looks sleepy." Blaze stretched out his leg, massaging his calf with his thumbs. "I've had a few hours to think here, which, for one thing, is a few hours we're not spending getting swords into the hands of villagers. For another, What's the point of chasing after the world's greatest bow when the whole idea is to avoid war? Every day we're down here is a gamble. If the wrong person gets wind that we're arming the Norren and brings that to the palace in Setevan, how long before the entire Gascon Empire is marching on the Norren territories? 3 seconds. Dante crunched into a bit of bread, chewing thickly. Now what if we have a bow that can drop their towers as fast as you drop your trousers? Won't that give them second thoughts? And you really think this thing exists? A bow that can win a war by itself? What are you, an idiot? Blaze threw up his hands. If this is a joke, then so is the fist I'm about to put through your teeth. Dante pulled his mind from the creatures, where Morn was chopping long, straight branches and leaning them against the low crotch of a tree. I just think it's worth sacrificing a couple days to confirm it doesn't exist. At least we'll have finally seen the Clan of the Nine Pines for ourselves. I heard they once killed an entire Setevan troop over the suggestion they start paying taxes. Don told me they give their children knives as soon as they can stand, accidentally cutting themselves as part of the process of learning to use one. Well, we've got to get those guys on board. King Modigan's army doesn't stand a chance against the knife babies. Blaze blew into his hands. I'll give it 2 more days. Past that, I will begin shrieking until you admit your mistake. 2 days later. 2 long, cold, relentless days of aching feet, stiff fingers, and dwindling bread that didn't taste good even when his belly was empty, and Dante was ready to turn back himself. Morn's course kept his resolve from dissolving completely. The Norren was headed straight into nowhere. An eastern course into grassy hills and patchy woods, too removed from the roads to see any signs of people besides the occasional hermit or roving tribe. Desolate and windy. A person could spend weeks combing these lands without finding a trace of the people he was after. That afternoon, Morn and his undead pursuit entered a wall of trees whose small green buds were just beginning to displace the stubborn, brittle leaves still hanging from their branches. Deep shadows pooled the ground. Morn walked noiselessly, hardly stirring the crackly blanket of leaves. After spending a good portion of the last few years learning to do the same, Dante envied the large man's effortless skill. Yet, with the sun a hand's breadth from the hills, its light fading from the soil like a summer rain, Morn suddenly began scuffling his feet, trampling through great beds of leaves as if shouting his name to the world. Ahead, a quiet blue lake winked between the trees. Above its shallow, grainy banks, Morn was greeted by a trio of tall, stone-faced Norren. "Found them," Dante muttered. "How many?" He stopped, ordering the distant skeleton to take a quick jaunt. Men and women sat around the fires, hauled wood, reeled in nets from the shore. 50, maybe more. "I have a thought," Blaze said. "If these people are as brutal as they all say, is it wise for 2 strangers to burst in on their secret forest lair?"
"Good question," rumbled a voice to the left.
Adrenaline bloomed from Dante's solar plexus. He dropped into a low stance, drawing his sword with his right and the nether with his left. Blaze whipped out his blades with a leathery hiss. 20 feet away, a man stepped from the trees, young enough that his beard only climbed halfway up his cheeks, but still 1 foot 2 tall to be mistaken for a human. A cleaver-like blade hung from his hand, the weapon as oversized as his bearish body.
"We're not enemies," Dante said. "The clan'll be here to judge that in a minute."
Dante flicked his eyes closed. At the camp, men and women grabbed up swords and bows and raced into the woods, backtracking Morn's route. He ordered the creature to follow them back. He reopened his eyes on the lone Norren.
"How did you alert them?"
"Josin Joe watches out for us all."
Tell them to bring steak, Lay said. I'm starving. He put away his swords, a motion so smooth that was like watching a feat of actual magic. Dante, unable to draw his blade without glancing at the handle first, left his out. He didn't say another word until Morn arrived in the dusk with a dozen other Norren, each dressed in the same supple deer leather and silver ear piercings. Surprise, confusion, and anger battled for control of Morn's heavy eyebrows. "Hi, Morn," Dante said. "We followed you."
"I would have seen you from a mile away."
"That's why we stayed 2 miles behind." The other warriors regarded Dante with blank eyes, thick swords held before them. Dante had guided the dead watcher into some shrubs behind him. He blinked, glimpsing a silent woman stalking straight for him, a knife gleaming in her hand. Without turning, Dante knocked her to the ground with a club of nether, forceful enough to rattle her plate without cracking it. "I am Dante Galland, council member of the sealed citadel of Narashtavik. We're here for the cause of Norren independence."
"I'm a guy in the forest," said a middle-aged Norren, whose left cheek was nearly beardless for all the scars. "And you are a long way from Narashtavik."
"Consider it a sign of our sincerity," Blaze said.
"Sincerity? You have strange words for trespassing strangers."
Slowly, as a stalking cat, Dante drew his lowered blade across the back of his left hand. The cold metal bit into his skin, replaced by the warmth of a fresh wound and the hot blood dripping from the edge of his palm. Nether flocked to the fluid in swerving twists of darkness. "You know why we're here," he said. "With that bow, we could guarantee Setevan wouldn't dare set foot in the territories."
"There is a problem," the scarred man said.
"A problem the severity of which depends greatly on your perspective," said a female Norren, no shorter than the males, yet significantly less hirsute. Her eyes were as orange as a harvest moon. "From your perspective, it is not so auspicious at all." The scarred man waved the point of his ponderous sword at knee level, as if it were too heavy to lift without great cause.
"Strangers who come to the clan of the Nine Pines are required to leave as ash on the wind."
A dozen Norren lifted their weapons. Further back among the trees, others knocked arrows, sighting down the shafts.
"Why does everything have to be a fight with you?" Blaze said sidelong.
He bared his teeth and raised his blades.
Dante summoned the nether to him in a great and hungry rush. For months, he had spent his free hours practicing the creation of lights and illusions, bending the nether into gigantic patterns, letters, and symbols that could be seen and interpreted from miles away. If some of Narashtavik's priests and monks were placed along the border, they could fling up the signs at the first sign of Gascon troops. Other scouts could then recreate the signs with fires and mirrors, passing the information deeper and deeper into the territories. Enough of these signalmen, in the right locations, and in the span of hours, crucial news could be transmitted hundreds of miles to Narashtavik and the territories. Those in the path of the coming storm would be given precious extra days of warning. This was the theory. In practice, men and women able to bend the energy of ether and nether were somewhat too rare to exile to mountaintops across the countryside. Yet the potential of this notion compels Dante to look past the impracticalities, and he'd spent many nights, when he wasn't too bone-tired to do anything at all, turning the darkness of the nether inside out, painting the air with blazing red letters, spelling, "Blaze is dumb," or with crude animations of the blonde man getting repeatedly whacked on the head by a succession of hammers. It was a challenging task, more subtle than skewering an enemy with a sudden spike of raw energy, and at first his concentration had been unable to sustain a moving image with any level of clarity for more than scant seconds, yet he kept at it. Recently, he'd been able to illustrate whole, if short, stories above his head, while grinning Norren bards chanted the poems his pictures matched. He hoped it would be enough. With the clan's warriors closing in, he dispelled the creature that had dogged Morn for 2 straight days. A light bloomed amidst the darkened treetops. The Norren tipped back their heads, eyes narrowed. At first, the image in the sky was nothing more than simple color, silvery yet soft to the eye. But it quickly took on the shape of a young boy, black-haired, blue-eyed, his features, even at the age of 5, sharp enough to skin a pear. High in the air, the glowing boy toddled through windy fields, overturning rocks at the edges of streams. By candlelight, a middle-aged man wearing a cassock and a kindly, if impatient, smile ran his fingers along the lines from a book of fairy stories. The next moment, the boy grew chest-high on the man, reciting unheard words from a book 3 times thicker. The boy grew taller yet. His dark hair flowed from his head, lengthening until it suddenly queued behind his head. By night, he walked down an overgrown lane, around him green outlines suggesting dense trees, where, in the basement of a ruined temple, he found a black book whose cover bore a stark white tree. The image shifted again. The young man sat at a library table, reading and rereading the book's opening pages. The scene leapt to a city street, cobbles and a flickering torch. A blond-haired boy stood beside the black-haired one, sword drawn against 2 armed and faceless men. The dark-haired boy, face twisted in terror, threw up his hand in a theatrical gesture. The group disappeared in a globe of darkness. When the scene returned to light, the 2 attackers lay dead. The images came fast. An old man lecturing the young man from inside a tomb, the blond boy with a noose around his neck, then racing away on horseback, the 2 boys riding north through the outlines of snowy mountains, arriving at Narashtavik, the dead city, a sketch of ruins and high citadel at its center. A stark-faced woman lectured from a cathedral podium. At the fringes of the crowd, the boys failed to fire their bows. But then they were inside the citadel where the woman lived and ruled, and then stood on a snowy march with her priests and soldiers, who battled rebels in a dark wood, before arriving beneath the boughs of a monstrous white tree, its heavy limbs grown of sleek and solid bone. Light flashed beneath the tree. Chanting faces summoned a black door. The old man reappeared in a scrum of bloody chaos. When it cleared, the woman was dead, alongside dozens of others. The image pushed in on the dark-haired boy's face, closer and closer, his blue eyes frozen on something far away, more cold and forlorn than that icy hill. He meant to do more, their return to the hills of the territories, the grain they'd deliver to the village on Clear Lake Hill, the pursuit of the man who'd slaughtered a Norren wagon train, but his strength faltered. The illusion vanished. Dante dropped to 1 knee, panting. The Norren looked down, blinking. Several dropped back a step. "There," Dante said. "We're no longer strangers." The scarred man glanced at the orange-eyed woman, then back to Dante. "Can you do more than find loopholes and paint pretty pictures?" "Yes." Dante let out a shaking breath. His head throbbed, overwhelmed. He blinked the blurriness from his blue eyes, swept sweaty black hair from his forehead. "Come at me, and I'll reduce you to the clan of the 3 or 4 pines before you bring me down." The woman gave the scarred man a small nod. "Why don't we take a walk to camp?" They led the way, distancing themselves to speak in soft, rumbling tones. Blaze elbowed him in the ribs. "I look much better than that." At least I omitted the wart, Dante said. Did you actually think that would have any chance of working? It seemed smarter than fighting. I don't think a dead body can tell me where its bow is, no matter how long I yell at it. Leaves crunched underfoot, smelling of sap and must. The afterimage of his work lingered in Dante's eyes, silvery flecks that flashed whenever he blinked. A pair of Norren followed them on either side, two more at their back. Blaze did nothing to disguise his stare. The Norren paid them no mind. Wood smoke sifted through the budding branches. They were directed to a patch of clear, bare earth not far from where the lake lapped softly on the muddy shore. The scarred man was named Orlin, the orange-eyed woman, V. They disappeared inside a leather yurt to continue their conversation, while Arlo, the young Norren who detained Dante and Blaze in the woods, brought out fried trout and raw greens. Blaze swallowed the crackly tail, then dug into the sweet, steaming white meat with bare fingers, plucking out ribs. "This entire trip is worth it now," he declared. "Even if we die, my ghost will agree." Dante dug his thumbnail against the scraps of green onion in his teeth. "I think we've reached the point where if they wanted to kill us, they'd kill us. Maybe we're being fattened. They're nomads, not cannibals. Maybe they're branching out." Around them, the Norren ate their own meals, stopping at the end to rip off the heads of cooked fish to suck out the eyes, then flinging the bony remainder into the lake. "Imagine those fish are you," Dante said. Orlin and V emerged from the yurt and approached the main bonfire. Without a word, 10 others joined them. The rest of the clan didn't look up, continuing to pick their teeth with fish bones and mend the nets they'd pulled from the lake. Dante raised his brows at Blaze and joined the Norren at the welcome heat of the bonfire. Orlin stared at them without blinking, even when the shifting wind drove stinging smoke into his eyes. "I don't know what you heard about us," the scarred chieftain said finally. "Likely you've heard several things. When a thing is unknown, like our clan, people will rush to fill the void of knowledge with whatever stories they like best." "We understand you want the same thing we do," Dante said. "An independent Norren state, free of tribute to or dependence on the nation of Garsk." "Vague enough to be a diplomat," V said. "Watch out for his promises." Dante scowled over the fire. "We know your clan has a long history of resistance against the capital. That's all we know. We've heard you possess a weapon called the Quivering Bow. If it does what rumor says it does, I think it could be a critical piece in forestalling a war, or in winning one, if the nobles at Setevan decide they've had enough of what's going on down here." Orlin inclined his head. "The bow. Yes. Then it's real?" "It has been a relic of the Clan of the Nine Pines for so long, none of us actually knows how we got it." V folded her large hands. "Maybe it was strung with the guts of the patriarch Bo's first son, or maybe we stole it from lesser people who weren't worthy of it." Dante's head tingled. "It can do what its name says, then. Shake down walls." "If you know how to use it," Orlin said. "And if you will use it to help free our people, you may have it, because what greater purpose could it serve? But there is a problem with it." "Not an insurmountable problem," V added. "It is not like the problem of why we are born, only to suffer and die." "Really, a rather minor problem, a dim constellation in the vast starscape of all that is wrong." Blaze pressed the heels of his hands to his forehead. "Have you ever considered this problem only exists because you're too busy talking about it to solve it?" "You see," Orlin said,
We don't know where it is.
Chapter 2
I see, Blaze said. Do you remember where you put it last?
Orlan narrowed his eyes. Smoke rose from the fire in white walls, screening the stars.
In the hands of a Gascon lord.
What?
Dante said.
It was taken, along with every member of our cousins, the Clan of the Green Lake, some weeks ago. When was that, V?
V tapped her hairless chin.
3 weeks ago. That was when we found the lake crabs, remember? On the way back from finding the bodies of our clan cousins. The empty yurts. The wailing young who'd hidden in the woods.
Oh, yes, the crabs. You do not often find the lake crabs. I had begun to think they'd all died out, or at least moved to another lake.
Dante pressed his fist against his lips, waiting for his anger to subside enough to open his mouth.
If the quivering bow has been taken, I pledge our immediate support to getting it back.
Blaze cocked his head.
I call foul on that pledge. My support is thoroughly undecided.
If that bow has fallen into enemy hands, yes, yes, then we'll all spend our next Falmux Eve watching the bunny races in hell. I'd like to at least know why the clan hasn't already gone after the bow, and their cousins or whoever, before promising we'll do what they won't.
He glanced at Orlan. No offense.
None taken, the man said. We were simply waiting on the word of Joson Joe.
Joson Joe?
As in the god, Dante said.
Oh, Blaze said. That Joson Joe.
He looks out for the people, shows them the way when they're lost, despite only having one eye.
Orlan nodded.
He lost it in a bet, over whether he could put out his own eye.
I thought it was to use it as bait to finally catch Sansanaman, the eternal catfish, V frowned.
That doesn't make any sense.
You say you were waiting, Dante cut in.
Today, Joson Joe spoke to me. Orlan said, tomorrow we move.
Then I'd like to come with you. I can't speak for my friend.
The two Norrin leaders exchanged an unreadable glance. Orlan considered the fire.
Joson Joe said we'd find an unexpected and powerful ally. If you help us recover our cousin clan, you may have the quivering bow.
Dante extended his hand.
Agreed.
Good.
Orlan waved his thick hand.
Now please leave the fire and go to your tent. Outsiders aren't allowed here.
Dante forced his eyes not to roll. He stood.
I understand.
Morn appeared beside the fire.
Your yurt's over here. It doesn't smell very good.
He was right. Inside the deer leather tent, its fluffy cloth padding smelled musty and faintly fishy. Conditions made worse by the fact it was notably warmer than the outside air. Dante conjured a soft white light to illuminate the bare interior. Blaze slung out his blanket and sat down with a sigh.
This whole thing could be a wild goose chase, you know. And I don't see how a wild goose is going to do any good if its territories get invaded.
Dante licked his thumb and smudged away the black fringes of the fresh scab on his hand. Even if we don't come out of it with a weapon of awful power, rescuing their cousins will only strengthen one of the nastiest fighting units in the entire region. It's the opportunity to put down a group of Norrin slavers, too.
How is there any downside? First, we don't know the timescale. Second, if Kali needs to reach us, he may as well shout up his own ass for all the good it'll do him.
Since when did you care about what Kali wants?
It's not Kali I'm concerned about.
Blaze gestured at the wilds beyond the yurt wall.
My worshippers will have a tough time reaching my grave if I'm struck dead in some stupid forest. A long trek will just prove the purity of their faith. True enough. Make it a tasteful marker, though. No more than 20 statues of weeping women.
Dante woke in the pre-dawn darkness to the sound of feet squelching in the mud. He brought the nether to his hands, lying silent, until he remembered he was among a strange but hospitable people. He had been dreaming of walking through a forest like this one, but beneath the layer of leaves and grass lurked a gaping abyss, and his feet kept plunging into the open nothing, exposing them to the unseen and unknown beings lurking beneath. Outside, looming silhouettes stalked the shoreline, rolling up yurts and drawing in the nets.
Others knelt beside flat rocks, spread cloths to soak up any dew, and smoothed yellow parchment atop the cloths, preparing for the dawn light considered best for their stark line paintings. Smoked fish carried on the cold breeze.
When Dante returned from relieving himself, Morn waited by the tent. He had clearly been designated the go-between, the buffer between the strangers and the tight circle of the clan.
"We move in an hour," the Norin said.
"Assuming you want him to come,
alert the snoring thing you call your friend."
Blaze groused and hacked like an angry duck, but calmed down quickly over a breakfast of dried fish and herb-crusted bread. Minutes after dawn, the clan split into two parts, the young warriors and hunters ready to track down their cousins of the Green Lake, and those who'd stay behind. Those too old, young, or injured for travel, along with a small contingent of the battle-ready to provide for them and to see them from harm. There were no tears shed, no speeches or goodbye ceremonies. The travelers simply walked from the lake, while the remainder continued to mend nets, add brushstrokes to parchments, and pluck herbs from the boisterous woods.
"Now that's a farewell party," Blaze said. "Did anyone even bother to look up?"
"Either we'll be back or we won't," Morn said. "What's there to get so excited about?"
"Rum, corsets, the promise of rest at the end of a long day's travel."
"Fleeting distractions from the only thought worth having. You're going to die."
Blaze glanced from him to Dante.
"You two should talk. You're like two peas from the same moldy, withered, sprouted from a grave at midnight pod."
Dante snorted.
"Death's inevitability makes it the very thing least worth thinking about.
You don't see hermits retiring to mountain tops to contemplate the nature of smelling bad after a hard day's work."
Morn exhaled through his nose, the steam of his breath condensing in his mustache. "Well, you'll have plenty of time to think about how wrong you are once you're dead."
Birds twittered from bare branches. Warmthless sunlight fell from the canopy like an old acorn. When the group stopped to rest before midday, a quartet of hunters quickly returned with a steaming boar. The clan fell upon it, skinning, gutting, and butchering. A broad-shouldered, middle-aged woman, who Dante thought, but wasn't certain, was V's sister, allotted slices of liver and raw muscle to everyone on the march. Blaze sucked his down so fast Dante doubted he'd chewed, then handed off the remainder to be packed in thick fern leaves. The clan resumed the walk 2 hours later. The pace was steady, and perhaps comfortable by Norrin standards, but to Dante, whose legs were several inches shorter, it was just this side of grueling, worsened by toe-grabbing roots and heel-sliding slicks of rain-rotted leaves. He had to soothe his physical exhaustion with draughts of nether every couple hours, a trade-off that left his muscles relaxed and unsore, but which left something at his core lacking and ground down. Not his spirit, but something with more physical weight. Something more like his wind. He could see the strain in Blaze's face, too, the limp he tried to conceal as the sun shrank and his blisters swelled. Blaze would never complain about anything real, of course. Not in earshot of Dante, the Norrin, or any other being with a set of ears and the capacity for speech. When he slept, Dante swept the swelling from Blaze's feet, then collapsed into unconsciousness himself. By the second day, they were some 40 miles from the camp by the lake and 60 miles or more from the village where, until rumors of the bow ripped them away, they'd been drilling Norrin militia to stand against cavalry. Too heavy to ride anything but the biggest workhorses, Norrin had as little experience defending themselves from mounted riders as Dante had defending himself from rainbows. "Quite the walk," Blaze said once they'd pitched their yurt and sat down to rest in the twilight. "It's enough to make a man question where he's going." "After the one thing that can make a difference."
"Wild geese?"
"A stick. Specifically, a curved one that can destroy a fortress in a single shot." It was a concept, however simple, he hadn't been able to completely convey to Blaze, at least not in terms the blond man found convincing. Callie had first laid it out to Dante 1.5 years ago, on a brief return to the sealed citadel in Narashtovik, a summer visit where the bayside humidity was nearly intolerable, even at the top of the high, breezy tower where Callie liked to literally look down on the citizens, shouldering each other aside in the narrow streets beyond the citadel walls. The sapling-thin old man hadn't spoken for some time after Dante joined him on the stone balcony, which was fine with Dante, so long as he was standing still. He could almost stop sweating.
"How do you fight a war that isn't a war?" Callie said at last. "More properly, how do you avert the war in the first place?"
He ran knob-knuckled fingers through a beard he refused to comb, despite years of protests from the servants tasked with making the council look properly holy.
"Think of it this way. A man with a club only has to shake it around and scream a little to convince the man without a club to back down. We're the man with the club, but we don't actually want to strike Setevan, the unarmed man, just to menace them into doing what we want, i.e. letting the Norrin do whatever they want."
Dante frowned. "But in this case, the other man is actually many thousand men, and instead of being unarmed, they're actually carrying an army's worth of swords, spears, bows, axes."
"Yes, well, no need to get literal. It's about the idea. It's about convincing them they feel like a helpless man, while believing we're waving about a frightened and lethal club.
Have you ever considered writing a book? It would be a shame for this wisdom to be lost to the ages." Callie's brows arched into a scowl, a movement which, given their shrubby mass, might have forced a lesser man to sit down.
"I am trying to impart to you a philosophy of preparation that could save the lives of thousands. You could at least pretend to take it to heart."
"I'll take it to spleen."
"As there's no chance you'll take it to brain, I will consider that good enough. The point is, we couldn't possibly win a conventional war of army versus army. The alternative, then, is to explore all the ways to fight that aren't conventional, to find new clubs, and to steal them from the enemy."
Despite his efforts to wind the old man up, Dante had taken the idea to at least one and possibly several of his organs, and felt confident Callie would approve of his current detour. It was, after all, the pursuit of a very large and nasty bludgeon. If Dante had passed the opportunity by, Callie would no doubt have spent more time yelling at him than he would have spent chasing down the bow.
"You champion ideas like this all the time," he told Blaze.
"I think the only reason you're against it is because you didn't come up with it yourself."
"I'm just tired of being in the dark here."
Blaze elbowed Morn, who gave him a glare that could strike fire in a downpour.
"Joson Joe told you anything about when we might stop walking and start arriving?"
"Don't mock him."
"Well?"
"Any day now. The next one, I think."
Dante didn't allow his hopes up, but the next morning they intercepted the river where it weaved between modest hills and short cliffs, a quarter mile wide and as grey as the clouds overhead. A dirt path followed the shoreline. Within miles, the clan stopped.
V and a pair of warriors continued on to a cluster of dark holes speckling a rocky cliff above the stretches of flat green land bracketing the shores.
Kling, Morn explained. Home of the man who can point us toward our cousins.
Blaze nodded. Who aren't here themselves?
Oh, no. Do you expect everything in your life to be that simple?
No, but it's easier to complain as if I do. Thee and the others returned a half hour later. Though they made no specific announcements about it, Dante gathered that the coast had been cleared. The clan of the Nine Pines moved on as a whole, slipping double file down the hard-beaten path to Kling. From a distance, Dante hadn't seen anything but caves, and had marked the place as a literal backwoods. Just one step up, civilization-wise, from the nomad warriors he travelled with. Closer, though, he could see docks and barges past the trees at river's edge, and smelled that particularly potent brew of hog shit that only arises from organized farming. On the other side of the path, the fields were empty, brown and tilled. The path switched from dirt to a bizarre foreign material. Dante could see no seams in it, suggesting a single sheet of hard-fired clay or the like, yet the path's solid mass couldn't be anything but stone. He said as much to Morn.
"Best roadmaster in the territories, Cod," the Norrin said. "It's a wonder the humans haven't kidnapped him."
Despite stooping for a closer look, Dante could only make out a handful of seams separating the stones that formed the road. Most were artfully concealed as part of the sandstone's grain, with others too fine to see even when he knew they must be there. Nor did it try to imitate the straight lines of many well-paved roads. Instead, it followed the subtle contours of the landscape with the same integrity that the river followed the low places through the hills. Indeed, given its appearance as a single flow of stone, it was possible, if you looked at it in the right way, to see the road as another river, a heavy creek from a realm where frozen water didn't form ice, but stone. He grew dizzy and straightened up. "This must have taken an eternity to build."
"Cod doesn't build. He sculpts."
"Sorry," Dante said. He should have known better. When it came to tangible objects like the road, Norrin approached their craft with the same dedication and piety as a prophet approached his lord. He had once seen an old woman go on carving a soapstone owl while her house literally burned down around her. Only when she passed out from the smoke had her son been able to drag her from the flames. "I've never seen anything like it."
"Of course you haven't."
Ahead, Orlin came to a stop. The clan stood in a square as finely cobbled as the road, a shallow bowl of seamless stone, the natural colours of which painted a vast mosaic of a salmon, its upper jaw as wickedly curved as a hawk's. At one end of the plaza, a single boulder, smooth and rounded as a river pebble, served as a podium or dais. Wooden shops ringed the plaza, some utilitarian, some elegantly simple, but beside the mastery of the plaza and the roads feeding into it, all equally forgettable. The land between plaza and river was grassy and empty, probably a field for festivals, prayer, and whatever else drew the crowds. The clan set camp in a field between the docks and warehouses. Flat-bottomed boats drifted downriver, bulging with barrels and tarps. Uphill, the black eyes of caves gazed down on the mild bustle of the port town. While the rank-and-file warriors spread blankets and rolled out the yurts, Orlin and V started up the road switchbacking Kling's highest hill. Blaze visored his hand against the afternoon sun.
Where are they off to?
To see the mayor about the kidnappings, Moyne said.
Dante gestured uphill.
Then let's go.
Oh, that's not allowed.
How are we supposed to help track down your cousins when we can't question the only people who know where they went?
By letting V and Orlin ask the questions themselves, and then by following them.
To hell with that. Blaze took off jogging. And not the hell for fun people, either.
Morn dogged their heels, running close enough to trip them.
You can't go up there.
Dante didn't look back. Our upward progress suggests otherwise.
Pedantically speaking, you can move up this hill, but don't say I didn't warn you when they throw you back down it, because that is what I am doing right now.
They caught the two clan chieftains before they were halfway up the switchback. V gazed at Morn with distilled reproach, her orange eyes withering him. Orlin coughed into his hand, and then considered the contents of his palm as if they contained a half-ruined map.
No, he said.
No what?
Dante said.
Further.
Why on earth not?
Because you are human, and this is Norrin business for Norrin ears.
At first he thought this was a strange joke. In contrast to every other part of them, the ears of Norrin were bewilderingly small, coin-shaped, and often lost beneath their tangled hair. But Orlin and V were staring at him with the gravity of a prince's funeral.
I'm aware of your tradition, he tried, but given how many lives may be at stake, I think an exception...
V shifted forward.
The next step you take up this hill will be your last with the clan.
She drew her brows together.
That sounded more ominous than I meant. I didn't mean we'd throw you down the hill, just that you'd no longer be permitted to travel with us.
This is stupid, Blaze said,
but apparently had nothing more convincing than that. Considering the affair settled, the two Norrin chieftains turned and continued uphill.
Morn folded his arms. See how futile that was.
So what now? Sit around and wait to be told what's next?
No, Morn said. You don't have to sit.
But Dante was tired from yet another day of relentless walking, so sitting beside his tent in the field was exactly what he did. At least until he nodded off. At which point he slumped around, waiting for word from above. News arrived after nightfall, when Blaze shoved him all the way over, jarring him awake. Orlin and V had returned from the hill. He roused himself, knees popping, and headed to the shoreline. Boar roasted over a fire pit, smogging the air with rich, crackling meat. At the water, bulky silhouettes cast nets fringed with small rock weights. The two chieftains sat on their heels by the fire, gnawing pork, wiping their greasy faces with their sleeves. Dante sat across from them.
Did you find anything out?
Yes. Orlin thought for a moment. That the mayor had nothing to say on the matter.
But I thought he'd seen them.
V wiped the back of her hand across her mouth.
He said the slavers didn't pass through here after all, which doesn't tell us nothing. It tells us the slavers didn't pass through here.
Frustration welled in Dante's throat.
I thought Jothun Joe told you to come here for answers. He did.
And here we are, Orlin said, which is closer than we were before.
V raised her right fist and held it to a coin-sized ear.
Where we'll wait to hear from Jothun Joe again.
Dante nodded, too wound up to speak. Blaze gestured downriver. Dante followed him along the pebbly shore, where the smell of wet moss and faint fish carried on the river's gentle waves. Morn walked some ways behind. When they paused, the Norrin did too, crouching beside the water and pretending to investigate the rocks. He pursued Dante and Blaze all the way to the other side of the piers, where the town ceased and the waterfront woods resumed. Dante stopped there, gazing out across the wide black river. "I'm beginning to think they should be enslaved,"